10 years ago, the Central African nation of Rwanda plunged into chaos and carnage following a suspicious plane crash that killed the country's president. Government soldiers and militia gangs killed 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus in less than 100 days. Many were hacked to death by machetes. The Rwanda genocide is now recognized as a colossal humanitarian and diplomatic disaster for outside powers, including the United States. In this report, produced in cooperation with the PBS program Frontline, Michael Montgomery of American Radio Works has the story of the policy battles that accompanied the West's failures in Rwanda.
10 years ago today, Monique Mujawa Maria was on the run. She had survived an assassination attempt that left her face visibly scarred. And on April 11, 1994, she managed to elude death squads that had already murdered some of her family in Kigali, the Rwandan capital. A human rights worker born to a Hutu father and Tutsi mother, Monique contacted friends who helped her get to the United States. In Washington and New York, she embarked on a frantic effort to alert the Clinton administration, the United Nations, and the media to the tragedy unfolding in her own country. She wanted to mobilize action on Rwanda.
It is something that I've lived with for a long time, that in America I would meet people who were very touched by what was going on, but who were not ready to invest any of their political capital.
Monique had a connection to the White House. 4 months earlier, she had met President Clinton at a reception. So together with fellow human rights worker Allison DeForge, Monique met with Clinton's national security advisor, Anthony Lake.
I was moved and terrified for her by her story of barely escaping.
Anthony Lake remembers Monique's plea for help, along with those of other human rights groups. He also remembers hearing few concrete ideas about what should be done.
And I remember at the end saying, what can we do? As I recall, they did not say, you need to look at an intervention, you need to get the UN forces in there. And of course, human rights activists do not necessarily think in terms of in those days, in terms of military interventions automatically. But what they said was, or broadcast the names of the people who are responsible for this, and it may deter them. And I asked for the names, and it was on the airwaves very quickly.
But broadcasting the names of Hutu extremists did not stop the human slaughter. Within the first 2 weeks, as many as 100,000 Rwandans were killed. Allison DeForge says it was clearly a genocide, and she wanted Western governments to say so.
What we had asked for was a clear statement signed by Clinton, by the French president, by Belgium, the major donor countries to Rwanda, simply saying what is happening in this country is a genocide, we condemn it, and we will not ever give any assistance to this government in the future.
But the Clinton administration rejected the idea and avoided any use of the term genocide. And there was a reason. One legacy of the Nazi Holocaust was an international convention requiring action to stop future genocides. The United States was a party to that convention, but the Clinton administration wanted to stay out of Rwanda. Allison DeForge says administration officials avoided using the word genocide, regardless of the mounting evidence.
When we talked about genocide with policymakers, it was clear that their response to us never gave the word back. Right? That was simply a word that was not being used.
At the peak of the slaughter, as many as 40,000 Rwandans may have been killed in a single day. Yet most administration officials stuck to script, like U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Madeleine Albright, when pressed by a reporter about the genocide convention.
Given that so many people say that there is genocide underway or something that strongly resembles it, why wouldn't this convention be involved?
Well, I think, as you know, this becomes a legal definitional thing, unfortunately, in terms of as horrendous as all these things are, there becomes a definitional question.
If I have to look at things, shameful failures, that certainly rises right to the top of it.
Charles Moose was Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs.
It is ludicrous, in retrospect, that the discussion was about, well, what might we be viewed if we declare that there is genocide and then we are not in a position or not ready or willing or able to do anything about it. The fact of the matter is it was there, and the fact that we didn't say so was already tarnishing our credibility and our capacity to do something about it.
At the UN Security Council, the world's other major powers were no more receptive to calls for action. 6 months earlier, the UN had sent peacekeepers to help implement a power-sharing accord between Rwanda's Hutu-dominated government and Tutsi rebels. But that accord was dead, along with 10 Belgian peacekeepers murdered by Hutu extremists. So in spite of the widening slaughter, the Security Council voted unanimously to cut the UN presence in Rwanda to a token force of 270 soldiers. Major Brent Beardsley was military assistant to the UN commander in Rwanda, General Romeo Dallaire.
The world just didn't care, and it made no difference what you said or how you said it to them. We could have packed up dead bodies, put them on a Herc, flown to New York, walked into the Security Council and dumped them on the floor in front of the Security Council. And all that would have happened was we would have been charged for illegally using a UN aircraft.
Anthony Lake remembers there was no public support for a multinational intervention or for the United States to act alone.
It was almost literally inconceivable that American troops would go to Rwanda. There was no appetite in the international community for such an effort, and I might add, not just among other governments. And, of course, some of the governments that had troops there were extremely anxious to get out and stay out. But in the whole international community, editorial writers, legislatures, other African governments, even NGOs.
By late May, as many as 500,000 Rwandans were dead. Hundreds of thousands were in mortal danger. At that moment, President Clinton announced a new policy directive. Speaking to graduates at the U.S. Naval Academy, President Clinton said that in order for the United States to support a UN peacekeeping operation, there had to be a direct benefit to U.S. national interests.
Now the entire global terrain is bloody with such conflicts from Rwanda to Georgia. We cannot solve every such outburst of civil strife or militant nationalism simply by sending in our forces. We cannot turn away from them, but our interests are not sufficiently at stake in so many of them to justify a commitment of our folks.
Clinton's directive made purely humanitarian intervention all but impossible. Michael Sheehan served in the U.S. mission to the United Nations. He says the new Clinton doctrine was driven by the murders of 18 U.S. servicemen on a U.N. mission in Somalia the previous October.
It was a very, very frustrating period because as soon as this document comes out, we have a situation of enormous humanitarian consequences unfolding in front of our eyes. But it was very, very difficult for the administration. The Clinton administration was brought to its knees by the problem in Somalia. There was no democratic political operative that could advise President Clinton to virtually turn around the ships steaming out of Somalia and send them back into a new African adventure of a raging civil war in the early parts of this genocide.
Administration officials now say they did not grasp the full scope of the killings until it was too late. But top secret documents made public this month by the National Security Archive, a nonpartisan research group, tell a different story. U.S. intelligence reports circulated to senior officials concluded as early as April 23rd that the slaughter in Rwanda amounted to genocide. While mid-level officials were pressing for tougher action, higher-ups in the Clinton administration also worried that any intervention force would land in the crossfire between government forces and the Tutsi rebels. And senior Clinton officials expected the Tutsi army to win. Anthony Lake.
Fastest solution to the genocide probably was the victory of the Tutsi forces.
Others disagree. The former UN commander in Rwanda, General Romeo Dallaire, says the U.S. strategy amounted to doing nothing and letting the slaughter continue.
And to say that what the best thing was to do to let them fight it out is actually condoning the government forces in doing not only the fighting on the line, but continuing the killing and slaughtering behind the line. But ultimately, that's what the Americans were aiming for. They didn't want to get involved.
By early June, Washington faced growing criticism on Rwanda, enough that Clinton administration officials loosened their language guidelines. Now, a spokeswoman could use the term genocide cautiously.
We have every reason to believe that acts of genocide have occurred.
How many acts of genocide does it take to make genocide?
That's just not a question that I'm in a position to answer.
Shortly after this exchange on June 10th, the death toll in Rwanda exceeded 700,000.
The blood is on the floor is so thick it's dried to kind of a muddy brown dust.
NPR reporter Michael Scholar came upon the scene of a government-sponsored massacre. It was one of many that occurred in public places where Tutsis had fled for safety.
By the altar there, probably about 30 bodies clustered around. One is the body of an infant with the parents, it seems, on either side. Above the whole scene, above the altar, is a small wooden statue of Christ with one hand raised.
By early July, Tutsi rebels captured Kigali. The 100-day genocide was over. Monique Mujawamariya, the Rwandan human rights worker, failed in her mission to mobilize Western action. Now living in Canada, she takes some solace in the fact that the Rwanda genocide is widely recognized, and a UN tribunal has prosecuted many of the ringleaders. But as the world marks the killing of some 800,000 Rwandans 10 years ago, Monique says she feels only a deep, profound sorrow.
All Rwandans are in tears for their loved ones. We have lost family, friends, and it leaves a great emptiness. It is very difficult when you go back to Rwanda. You feel like a stranger in your own country. There is nobody you know and no one who remembers you. It's not easy.
Over the years, President Clinton and other world leaders have traveled to Rwanda to express remorse for not doing more. This week, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan announced plans for an early warning system and a special advisor on the prevention of genocide. But Kofi Annan says he can't rule out the possibility of another genocide sometime, somewhere. For American Radio Works and NPR News, I'm Michael Montgomery.
American Radio Works is the national documentary unit of Minnesota Public Radio. This story was produced in cooperation with the PBS program Frontline. For more about the genocide in Rwanda, please go to our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.